Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney has vowed to repeal the Affordable Health Care Act if elected, and the nation remains split on President Obama's landmark legislation. But does it matter any more than the economy, more than jobs? Joining us now to talk about all of that and more is NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Hi, Ann. Happy 5th.
Thank you. Happy 5th to you. Gal darn middle of the week holidays, right?
Yeah, I know. It's not my favorite, but, you know, I only have just so much power. So.
Yeah, right. Good point.
Yeah.
All right. So does, first of all, just the impact of this ruling, does it matter more than the economy? Does it matter more than jobs? What does it matter?
Well, yeah, no, it doesn't. I mean, nothing matters more than jobs. I mean, obviously, anybody will tell you, both sides will tell you, all sides with Ann Fisher, of course, but both sides, Obama and Romney, will say that it's the jobs and the economy and things like that. But having said that, it does put both camps, at least, you know, in this early July, on notice that it's going to be it's a tough issue for both of them, because President Obama, when he pushed through this Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, he said this is not a tax. I will not put an additional tax on middle-class Americans. And the Supreme Court said, well, lo and behold, it is a tax. Now, of course, Mitt Romney is vowing to repeal Obamacare, in his words, but as governor of Massachusetts, his health care plan had that mandate that if you didn't sign up to get sign up for the health care bill, you'd have to pay this mandate, this penalty. And Romney's also having to have this, you know, this juggling act, whether what he did in Massachusetts was a tax increase or not, which he keeps saying it's not. So Romney says what he did was a penalty. What Obama's doing is a tax raise. And again, it's the old charge of flip-flop with Mitt Romney that's coming back to haunt him.
Well, I mean, flip-flop. Spokesperson earlier was saying that they agreed that it wasn't a tax.
Well, yeah, he had to say that because if the Obama healthcare bill is, if Obamacare is a tax increase, then Romney Care in Massachusetts was a healthcare bill. So, you know, as Rick Santorum and other opponents of Romney said throughout the primaries, that healthcare is the worst issue in the world for Romney to run on, given what he did in Massachusetts. So, you know, ultimately, is what Romney did yesterday a flip-flop? Perhaps. But I think in the long run, he had to do what he had to do. He has to say, along with the rest of the Republican Party, that what Obama has pushed through is a tax increase. And the short-term problem of Romney once again being called a flip-flopper, I think, you know, he had really no choice but to do that, because otherwise he's at odds with the rest of the Republican Party.
Bill and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Yeah, just a question. One person told me that if Romney would go on the attack in the sense that he would predict what the president will do between now and the election, he wins either way. For example, on Keystone, he would say Obama will approve Keystone between now and the election. If Obama does not, Romney wins. If he does, Romney wins.
Well, that's kind of interesting. I'm wondering if all the things that could potentially hurt President Obama winning a second term. I mean, there are so many of them, and of course, it's the unemployment and the lack of jobs in the future, at least the confidence about the economy. And maybe that's why the White House is focusing everything on Bain Capital and outsourcing. The White House is not talking about an improving economy. It's not talking about a favorable jobs report. It's talking about what Romney did at Bain Capital, and it seems like that seems to be the White House strategy all along. Because if it's about the Obama record, the president is in big trouble. If it's about Romney and what he did at Bain, that could be his salvation for a second term.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. If other listeners out there would like to give us a call, talk with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, please do. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to our Facebook page as well and post your question or comment there. So tax or penalty, how much of a gaffe was it, though, with Romney's chief spokesman and longtime aide, on MSNBC the other day. That's all out there now.
Well, the same aide is the same guy who said the Etch-a-Sketch line.
Oh,
Eric,
yeah,
Princeton.
That's right.
Yeah, so, I mean, he has, you know, so
he's got a history.
He has been with Romney a long time, mm-hmm. and so obviously there's no question about loyalty, but sometimes when somebody on the campaign says something that the candidate wishes he didn't, it causes problems. But I'm not convinced that what Fenstrom said earlier in the week about it being a penalty and not a tax is not what Romney
right.
would have liked to, the argument he wanted to make, because then it goes back to his stewardship in Massachusetts. But, I mean, it seems, this is really a campaign tactic both on both sides. It really has nothing to do with this law, the Affordable Care Act, is good for the country or not, and you can make the arguments for both sides. But right now we're talking about semantics, and you know, I've never been accused of being anti-semantic. But I mean, it just, you know, just goes on and on and on, and this is what politics is all about. And besides, there's nothing else going on.
Rupert Murdoch, CEO of News Corp, and Jack Welch, former CEO of General Electric, they've called on Romney to dump his staff, and I would imagine people, including Eric, Romney has said he's standing by his team. What's going on with that, asking him to dump his staff?
Well, they feel that Obama is winning the war, at least the winning the weeks, like ever since the Supreme Court ruled about the Arizona immigration law and things going on. They feel that Obama is getting the headlines, getting the favorable headlines. And given the fact that many in the business community feel that Obama must be defeated, and the fact that that Romney is not winning the argument, at least, you know, in the last couple of weeks, they feel that he should be much more aggressive. But, I mean, true, it's only July, but you could also make the case that if this continues, it may be too, you know, it may be, if the issue, again, becomes Romney and his inability to explain his Bain Capital days, then it may be too late. So I think a lot of the business folks are saying, we got to beat Obama, and the way to do it is to change the team before it's too late. But ultimately, look, it's about Romney, and this is what Mitt Romney is all about. And we kind of knew that these were some weaknesses during the primaries. And if he's going to win, he's going to have to step up the attack and make it more about Obama in the last 3 years and less about Romney and Bain Capital.
Steve from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My comment is I've never heard any analyst or anybody say that when Obama helped bail out the auto industry, he not only saved Democratic jobs, but there are a lot of Republicans and Tea Partiers that work for auto industries or spinoffs businesses from the auto industries.
Well, yeah, and plus the fact Romney essentially is from Michigan. Of course, his father was governor there. Mm-hmm. He was born in Michigan. It's one of his home states. But, you know, Romney has that conundrum perhaps you can make the case that the bailout of the auto industries did save tons of jobs. And, of course, we're just talking about jobs. We're not talking about Democratic jobs, Republican jobs, Tea Party jobs, independent jobs. We're talking about jobs that affects everybody. But at the same time, Romney is the spokesperson, is the leading figure of a party that is against bailouts. And while you could say that maybe the auto bailout worked, but did the bailout of the banks work? I mean, the banks, what I've seen is the banks, if anything, have just gotten bigger and richer. And you know, I'm wondering if everybody else has benefited along with the banks. So there are two arguments about the whole thing, whether the bailouts worked. But for Romney, he's in that kind of difficult situation. He wants to win in states like Michigan. He wants to win, you know, the so-called Reagan Democrats, these union folks who just may, you know, have not benefited from the economy, the economic times. But if, you know, if you're going to attack bailouts and you're going to attack the auto industry, Michigan, you know, if Romney's going to win the White House, he's going to have to win, obviously, states that Obama carried in 2008. And Michigan is one of the states he'd like to carry, but not if you're running against, you know, the auto industry.
Thanks, Steve, for the call. Take care. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call and once again talk with Ken Rudin. Let's turn to Attorney General Eric Holder. Can we call him the embattled Attorney General Eric Holder?
Okay. I think we could.
Republicans have, he says they've made him a proxy to attack the president during an election year.
Well, I mean, look, Eric Holder has not been the Republicans' favorite attorney general, and Eric Holder mm-hmm. is a clear Obama loyalist. You know, unlike, like, for example, Janet Reno, she was seen as more of an independent attorney general during the Clinton administration. But the focus of the Republican ire right now is on the so-called Fast and Furious program, in which the United States watched guns go into Mexico to monitor them to see when they went, you know, if they would go to the cartel and things, the drug cartel. But as it turned out, our government lost track of many of these guns, and one of which was used in the killing of an American border agent. So Daryl Issa and the Republicans in the House said, look, this is ridiculous. We need more information from the ATF and the Justice Department. And, of course, Holder has withheld much of the information, and Obama, President Obama himself, has talked about, he's invoked executive privilege. And the House said, well, okay, you know, you're not going to give us the information we want. We're going to hold you in contempt of Congress. Now, of course, this is a historic move by Congress. Congress has never held an attorney general in contempt. Democrats, I mean, first of all, 17 Democrats voted for the contempt citation. Mm-hmm. More than 100 Democrats walked out of the House during the vote, saying this is blatantly political, that the Republicans are playing, just, you know, using the Holder thing to embarrass the White House. But the two sides are not, you know, they're obviously at loggerheads. The House voted to, look, the Senate's not going to do anything. The Justice Department has already said that it's not going to prosecute Holder for anything, and you know, Holder himself is probably going to leave the administration by the end of the year. Is it politics? Sure. I mean, you know, the Democratic Congress went after Alberto Gonzalez and other members of the Bush administration, you know, holding them in contempt, things like that. So, I mean, not the cabinet members, but members for lack of providing information. It's a game both sides play. Is it political? Probably. Is there? But you know, that's a pretty resounding vote against Eric Holder, and was it on party lines? Sure, but as I said, 17 Democrats, right. And I was surprised about that, 17 of them voted for contempt.
You mentioned in your blog that the National Rifle Association had announced that the contempt vote would be a key one on the NRA scorecard. Could that be behind some of those votes, maybe?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we always talk about profiles and courage. It would be nice if somebody said, look, you know, I don't care if this is going to jeopardize my career. This is the wrong thing to do. But when you hear Leonard Boswell, who's basically a party line guy from Iowa, from Des Moines, saying, well, I'm voting to hold the attorney general in contempt. When you see Mark Kritz, the Democrat in Western Pennsylvania, who won John Murtha's House seat, and, you know, the Democratic establishment was so excited about that, to see Kritz vote for contempt as well. It's, you know, every now and then you'd like a Democrat or anybody to stand up and say, you know, I don't care if this hurts my career, it's the wrong thing to do, but not these guys.
My guest is Ken Rudin. He's NPR's political junkie. We have him for another 20 minutes, so if you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock for On Point. Carbohydrates get a new critical look as the bad boys of our national diet. On Point looks at the research this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 73 degrees in downtown Columbus with some scattered showers. Expect scattered showers and possibly a thunderstorm, mainly before 1 o'clock this afternoon. Otherwise, partly sunny and a high of 96. An excessive heat warning is in effect until 8 o'clock this evening. A slight chance of rain tonight, partly cloudy, a low of 74. Sunny and hot for Friday with a high of 99. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. We're talking politics for another 20 minutes. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call and join the conversation. So, Ken, Is there going to be a recount in the New York City in the primary win by apparent primary win by Charlie Rangel?
Well, this is interesting. Charlie Rangel, of course, the African American congressman from Harlem, first elected to Congress in 1970. Defeated the legendary Adam Clayton Powell. And when Charlie Rangel was first elected in 1970, it was an African-American district. It was like two-thirds black or three-quarters black. This was Harlem, after all, the capital of African-American politics in the country. But through redistricting, it's become more and more Latino. It's now a Latino-majority district. And it's interesting. He is a state senator that he's ran against. His name is Adriano Espaillat. And while on election night last Tuesday, 9 days ago, everybody thought that Rangel had won big. As it turns out, he now only has an 802 vote lead, and so the Espaillat people are going to court. They've gone to court, and they say, "Well, wait a second. For the long, for many of the Hispanic districts, there was absolutely no counting of Latino votes. What I'm saying is, in these precincts." Many votes were not counted at all, and these were thought to be very strong for Espaillat. So there's a lot of chicanery being alleged there. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that it's being used against the black political establishment. The rest of the country, it's the African-American neighborhoods that are complaining about vote suppression. And here you have Latinos talking about black vote suppression. So it's very interesting dynamic that's going on in New York between old line black political power and upcoming Latino political power. The recount starts today. Not a recount, but there are some 2,000 absentee ballots that have not been counted. But there's the possibility that the Espaillat people will say, "Look, this is it's rife with fraud, and we want a new election." And stranger things have happened in New York, so. We'll see, but this is pretty remarkable.
Are you surprised that Rangel did pull it off?
Well, he did have four opponents on the ballot. Matter of fact, third candidate was endorsed by the New York Times, which I thought was interesting. I don't know. He was, of course, censured by the full House. Mm-hmm. He's 82 years old. He's slow afoot. There have been ethics questions about Charlie Rangel for the longest time. If you believe in time for change, well, what better person to talk about than Charlie Rangel, who's been in there for, as I said, for 42 years. But at the same time, the establishment has always been behind him. Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, endorsed him. I think they wanted Rangel to go out on his own, win one more term, and then retire. But, people expected that in 2008 as well. Win one more term. He got censured, and then he should have retired, but he didn't. So there are some new folks in politics who say, "Look, I'm not going to sit around and wait on Charlie Rangel's time schedule. We're going to force the issue right now." But it's pretty remarkable, and it's really something to watch. I think Rangel holds on. I do, but it's not over.
James in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, James.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
I love the commentation. I love it. You guys are talking about all interesting stuff. I guess my thing is this. Why does it seem like the mainstream media is letting Mitt Romney off the hook? I mean, he's going back and forth, this and that. I'm for health care, it's not a tax. I save GM, yada, yada, yada. And nobody's asking this guy any hard questions. And he just seems to pass through the holes. I mean, nobody's talking about serious issues with this guy. And everything that comes out of his mouth is, it's Obama's fault. I mean, he's not even talking about a plan or this or that. It's all Obama this and Obama that. And they won't push him on it. They just won't push him on it. I don't understand.
James, I'm not sure if I agree with you. First of all, I don't think anybody's letting Romney off the hook. I think Romney has had a terrible bunch of weeks, especially this week, about the so-called flip-flop, whether it's a penalty or whether it's a tax. I think every newspaper in the country, matter of fact, if you look at the front page, there's a dearth of other news out there, of course, but the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post today, not that that's what representative of America, but they're also talking about, how Romney can't decide what message to give out. So I don't know if anybody's letting him off the hook. I think, but I do agree that it's one thing to say Obamacare must go. It's another thing to say about what are you going to do to replace it with, or what are you going to, what kind of a plan are you going to implement to replace it with? And he has not done that, and I think the media have given him, you know, a hard time for that as well. But also, when he says, you know, it's Obama's fault, it's Obama's fault. I mean, there are some people who can make the argument that for the last 3 years, Obama has been saying it's Bush's fault, it's Bush's fault. Now maybe it is Obama's fault, maybe it is Bush's fault, but that's the name of the game of you know, that's what politics is all about. And I don't think that, maybe I see it differently, but I don't think Romney is getting away with anything. I think he's having a really tough week, and he's not really getting his message across because as I said earlier in the show, this healthcare bill, this healthcare as an issue is just tough for him given his history as the governor of Massachusetts.
James, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it.
I still agree with James when he said earlier that this is a great show and we're very smart. I agree with that part.
Oh, that's right. Thank you, James.
Thank you, James. No, I'm teasing, but I just don't. I don't think Romney's getting away with anything.
Well, let's turn it and consider the President Obama. Now, I'm sure there are people out there who think he's getting a free ride, and I was kind of wondering about how much he really can use the Supreme Court decision to his benefit. On the other hand, the day that it came out, that one of the first things he did was, in my opinion, finally enumerate what's in the law, clearly.
Well, I still
he doesn't
think,
really do that much.
But see, remember, until the Supreme Court ruled, and it's interesting how John, you know, this was such a right-wing conservative court, and how the liberals hated this court because of Bush versus Gore, and they hated it because of Citizens United, and this is, you know, a bunch of right-wingers, and now all I hear about John Roberts, he looks like, you know, Earl Warren all over again, that the conservatives hate his guts. He's a traitor. He sold out the Constitution. It's remarkable how John Roberts, you know, vote in this healthcare thing has been interpreted. And it's just, it makes me giggle. But, of course, a lot of people are not giggling because they're so angry. But I don't know. I think that if you remember, if you looked at the polls prior to the Supreme Court vote, more people opposed it than supported it. A lot of people who like the bill have argued, have criticized the Obama White House for not making the case mm-hmm. for what's in the bill. Now, polls do show that since the court ruling, more people do support it. But again, it's, even with that, it's still split down the middle. And I kind of think that they would be, both sides would be very happy for different reasons to be arguing about the economy. Obama criticizing Romney for outsourcing of jobs, Romney criticizing Obama for the high unemployment rate, the lack of new creation of jobs. But I think that the healthcare bill has pitfalls for both sides, and I kind of think that both sides would be very anxious to move on from it.
Well, let's turn to another primary challenge. Orrin Hatch survived. You predicted it.
Well, yeah, I mean, most people did it. What happened mm-hmm. was Orrin Hatch, I mean, some of us think that Orrin Hatch is really, really a very strong conservative, but at the same time, he did talk, you know, he had the temerity to say nice things to Ted Kennedy. You know, he did talk to some Democrats, and some places like Utah, that's not a popular thing to do. And he has seen, like in 2010 in Utah, Robert Bennett, the other Republican senator there, was basically he was knocked out by the Tea Party because he was seen as insufficiently conservative. And in the Tea Party's defense, Robert Bennett did vote for some things that conservatives, you know, just made their skin crawl. But given the fact that Orrin Hatch watched what happened to Robert Bennett, and he did actually what Dick Lugar did not do. Dick Lugar saw the Tea Party coming into Indiana, and he said, you know, bring it on. And, of course, he got clobbered. Orrin Hatch realized that this is a very potent threat from the Tea Party. He became more and more conservative, more and more critical of Obama. And when, you know, when it came down to it last Tuesday, he won a pretty sizable primary victory over Dan Lilienquist, who was the conservative Tea Party candidate. Now, a lot of people have been saying that, you know, the fact that Orrin Hatch won means that the Tea Party is weakening. I don't think that at all. I think the fact that Orrin Hatch became more and more conservative, so conservative, because of fears of what the Tea Party could do to him in the primary, that to me, that means that the Tea Party is as potent as ever. And besides, 2 years ago, there were far more Democrats to go after. There were fewer Democrats this time. And I think that's one of the reasons the Tea Party is focusing more on Republicans.
You wrote about the issue of third-party candidates in your blog this week, and we often get calls and questions from listeners. You've received them on the air who wonder why third-party candidates are ruled out. They often blame the media.
Well, I think that's a fair criticism in the sense that, I mean, the media, the third-party candidates always say that, well, of course nobody's going to vote for us. The media refuse to write about us or talk about us. And then the media will argue and said, well, we'll talk about you if you, you know, if you have any signs of life. But right now, if we look at the polls, you know, the Libertarian candidate, the Green Party candidate, you know, on the right and left, they're just minimal. They're not getting any support in the nation. So why waste airtime and ink space talking about them? So that's frustrating for both sides, certainly about third party candidates. But if you listen to what a lot of people say, that we're so tired of the Democrats, we're so tired of the Republicans, we desperately need a change. Nobody's come forward. I mean, you know, there will be, of course, there will be a Green Party candidate, and it'll either be Roseanne Barr, the actress, or Jill Stein, an activist from Massachusetts. And, of course, there is a Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, the former Republican governor of New Mexico. But, you know, if you think of all the times they've been on the ballot, they've shown no support whatsoever. And it's frustrating for them because they say that they see that this anger out there with the two parties. But when push comes to shove, the voters go to the polls and they vote the D lever or the R lever, and very few independent or third-party candidates get votes.
You know, a few weeks ago, Mitt Romney's high school career was brought up. I think it was a Washington Post reporter. It might have been one of the Boston reporters who wrote the biography on him. Anyways, Josh Mandel, candidate for he's running against
Sherrod Brown, right?
And for the U.S. Senate seat in Ohio, a picture came out of him from high school. It was embarrassing. Then there was a whole bunch of pictures of famous people, including Dan Quayle and Rob Portman and all kinds of, I should say, politicians, not necessarily famous people. It made me think of Dan Quayle again and the choices we make or they make for their vice presidential presidential candidates. I was wondering what's new on that scene.
Well, on the vice president thing, or the fact that everybody had had history.
Everyone has a high school picture.
I mean, I think one.
I bet you do.
I think one of the reasons I have refused to run for president is because of these pictures sent. But anyway, the VP stakes. You know, I mean, I'm still betting. I mean, I'm 99% wrong. I think I've been right three times in my lifetime of picking vice presidents. But my prediction is there's a guy, he's not well known, but he's a guy named Rob Portman. He's a senator from the Midwest. And he's from Ohio.
Yeah.
But no, anyway, Portman is my prediction. I kind of think, I mean, there are a lot of people
really?
Say that we need Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, mm-hmm. because, you know, he loves to sock it to the Democrats.
Spicier.
He is spicier. I think he's a little too spicier for his own spice rack. But I'm kind of thinking that maybe Chris Christie would be a great keynote speaker at the convention and rile up the crowd. But ultimately, and I say this every 4 years, it is about the presidential candidates. And for all the excitement that Geraldine Ferraro or Sarah Palin may have brought, even temporarily, to the ticket, ultimately it's going to be the top of the ticket that's going to decide the election.
And how soon? I mean, when's that going to happen? It's got to be heating up now.
Well, it is. Of course, you know, the Republican convention isn't until the last week of August in Tampa, Florida, followed by the first week of September for the Democrats in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once upon a time, the conventions were the place where the nominees would be decided. And that stopped happening, you know, since 1968 mm-hmm. or, well, maybe later. Like Reagan Ford was kind of like a convention thing, and Kennedy Carter was kind of a convention thing. But then we always knew that the VP would be picked at the convention. I remember in 1980 in Detroit, I mean, I was just standing there and Ronald Reagan made a surprise visit. On the third day of the convention, they said, you know, you didn't expect me to come, but I just want to tell you that tomorrow I'm going to nominate George Bush as vice president. And we all like, I mean, it was just shocking. But now the conventions have none of that drama. The VP picks are from both parties are picked well in advance of the conventions. And you know that there's a lot of vetting going on in the Romney camp about whom to pick. And, of course, you know, a lot of people are still saying, do not do what John McCain did 4 years ago. In other words,
don't not vet.
Don't not vet. I mean, basically, that was a Hail Mary picking Sarah Palin. And while briefly it did excite the party, in retrospect, it was a disastrous pick, not only because of the Katie Couric interview and things like that, but just she was just so unprepared. So when you see names like Kelly Ayotte, the senator from New Hampshire, who's run for one office in her life, I mean, they keep talking about her as a potential vice president. They're not going to do something like that. So, but the question is whether you pick a pit bull like a Chris Christie, or you pick somebody who's more reliable and more, you know, probably more in tune with Romney's own persona, like a Rob Portman or a Tim Pawlenty, things like that. But it's going to come pretty soon. I mean, I think within the next month, certainly.
And by the way, Rob Portman's high school picture was kind of cool looking. Let's see. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you. I agree with James earlier that Ken is a great resource for NPR. Love to hear you talking.
Oh, thank you.
Wanted to mention my premise is that George W. Bush won re-election in 2004 because of the anti-gay marriage issue on our ballot, which energized the Bush supporters, and that helped him. Obviously, he had to win Ohio to win re-election, and he did. Now, the question is, there's a issue being contemplated again this year, and they say the environment is different, but what do you think? Do you think the environment is not really that different, and we have this possibility of the same thing happening, helping Mitt Romney get elected?
Well, Mike, thanks for the nice things to say, but I think the environment is different in the sense that certainly the American people seem to be more supportive of same-sex marriage than they were 4, 8, or you know, years ago. I think the conditions are better. Even the president has evolved. But the problem is, or the problem for same-sex marriage proponents is that even saying all that, every state ballot it's been on, it's been defeated. If you think of the 8 or 9 states where it's on now, it's only because of the state legislature or because of the courts. But every state, in California, supposedly liberal state, it was defeated. So you wonder if, look, I agree with you. I think Ohio was the ball game in 2004. I mean, I would also say that 9/11 played a big part in that election as well. But Ohio was was ground zero for the 2004 election and putting an anti-gay marriage amendment on the ballot certainly did help the Bush forces. And I don't know if it's going to have the same kind of effect. I still think that it will be about the economy, but in a state that's close, and again, if John Kerry had gotten 60,000 more votes in Ohio, he would have been elected president. So I mean, even if it is about the economy and the jobs and the future about, you know, the economy, there are some close states where a ballot initiative could make the difference. And as always, look, it's not a coincidence that President Obama begins a 2-day bus tour of northern Ohio today, because Ohio is one of the half a dozen or so key states that's going to determine the next president.
And just to clarify, Mike, by the way, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. Just to clarify, that ballot issue, that won't be on the ballot until 2013. That wouldn't affect this campaign cycle, this election cycle this time. It would be in 2013 if it makes it. So, Ken Rudin, thanks for joining us.
And it was a lot of fun.
Have a great rest of your week. And coming up, we're going to hear some music about Columbus. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News Team.
The appearance of the ads shows Central Ohio is changing from a heavily regulated electricity market to a more competitive one.
First Energy Solutions and other suppliers want an unfair advantage.
AEP's scheme will hurt our economy.
Thanks to the new law, AEP must sell some of its electricity to other power companies.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and join us later this afternoon for Talk of the Nation from 2 until 4. In the first hour of the program, Woody Guthrie wrote some of America's most important songs and inspired the folk revelation of the 50s and 60s to take on politics and civil rights. This month, he would have turned 100. Host Neil Conan celebrates Woody Guthrie's centennial from the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. It's Talk of the Nation from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
Support 89.7 NPR News at $85 and receive the WOSU member card. The member card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 300 member card partners in Central Ohio. Visit WOSU.org/member card for more information. 74 degrees in downtown Columbus, scattered showers and some light rain today, and then partly sunny skies and a high of 96, an excessive heat warning in effect until 8 o'clock this evening. There's a slight chance of showers for tonight, partly cloudy, a low of 74. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm walking down the street. We're running out of time.
That's the Castros with the song Here in Columbus. Welcome. Song and celebration are always a good fit, right? To celebrate Columbus's bicentennial, the same holds true. More than 100 local artists submitted their work for consideration on the Celebrate Columbus in Song CD. It was released last month and offers 13 original songs from local artists. Here to talk about the final result is Jamie Goldstein. She's Vice President of Marketing and Communications and Events at the Greater Columbus Arts Council. Jamie also was a member of the Celebrate Columbus in Song Committee. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Hi, Ann. Nice to be here.
And also with us in the studio is Ruvane Kurland. He is a Columbus-based singer and songwriter, and his song I'm Home is also featured on the album. Welcome to the show, Ruvane.
Thank you very much.
So, Jamie, this had to be difficult because 100 people submitted, and I'm sure there were some that were obvious throwaways, but there were probably some tough choices you had to make.
We had to make some very tough choices. I mean, this town is got so much talent musically and artistically in general, and we were really surprised by the number of submissions. I don't think we expected to get, it was 123 actually, to,
oh,
be,
really?
Exact, mm-hmm. to be exact. And so the committee that came together to try and whittle it down to a reasonable public vote, because we knew we wouldn't be able to ask the public to listen to 123 songs. We had to make some very tough choices. In fact, there were many that it was hard. It was just so hard.
Well, you had to make a list. You had to have some criteria. What were you looking at?
We did. First and foremost, the main criteria was that the song had to be inspired by Columbus. And it needed to really sort of capture the essence of this city in some way. We wanted diverse genres. And we really wanted to be able to represent the best of the musical talent here in Columbus. So we have some very well-known songwriters, and then we have some folks that people didn't know.
How many points did they get if they mentioned the Rose Garden?
We did
there
not
no
give
fewer
any
than three songs.
We,
did
we did,
there might
we,
be more.
We did not give any points for any specific mentions of any places or OSU or anything like that. But of course, all those things are very iconic to Columbus. So, so I think that they're very common things when our musicians are songwriting.
Like you said, you made some really tough decisions. Were there any? Could you have done two CDs?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I do believe that based on the number of votes that there's a possibility that if we'd had enough money, we could have probably put together yet another.
So how many did you put out to the public to listen to?
We put out 29 total for the public to listen to.
And what kind of response did you get to that?
We had almost 10,000 votes.
Wow.
People could vote for more than one song. We actually set up a system that they could put together their own mixtape, if you will. And so they could vote up to 10. But the average was a couple songs. So we had almost 5,000 individual votes with close to 10,000 total votes.
And with the submissions, were they all very professional at the outset, or did you have to work on them when it came to producing them for the CD?
No, for the most part, they were all fairly professional. We had a little bit of studio time that we had to do to get the tracks aligned and to get, you know, the master made. But for the most part, the musicians did most of the work themselves.
Yeah, you said there's some pretty, you know, famous, well, Mayor Michael Coleman does the introduction.
Well, it was his idea, this contest. So.
Right. And then there's the 200 Columbus Anthem by Milton Ruffin.
Who is the principal of Fort Hayes.
Okay. And here in Columbus, the Castros, which we opened with. In my town, Cesar.
Cesar is a young man who is a student at Fort Hayes. He just turned 16, and he was pretty much unanimously voted in. I mean, the song is really great, but he's also...
It is a good song.
He's a very articulate, smart young man who wants to make it big and completely credits this city for making him what he is.
The Street Where I Live.
Mm-hmm.
Diana Mogavero.
Mm-hmm. Of course, very, a very well-known Columbus songwriter, Diana.
Right.
She's done, I think one of her songs is the soundtrack for Experience Columbus's sort of promotional video about the city.
Did she compose that? Did everybody compose these songs for this CD?
Or were some
of them already composed?
I mean, there are musicians who, of course, written songs about Columbus. So they were able to submit. We didn't have to be original for this contest.
Well, joining us as well in the studio, as I mentioned, Ruvane Kurland. He's a singer-songwriter, and his song I'm Home is featured on the Celebrate Columbus and Song CD. Ruvane, what inspired you to enter this contest?
Well, a couple of years ago, I had put out an album, and one of the songs that I wrote while I was actually on tour was about, you know, some of the neat places that I visited around the country, and... you know, how nice they are, but the really fulfilling moment of coming back home. And so when I saw the contest was open, I thought, oh, this is the perfect song for this. And I guess one of the neat things was that the committee allowed previously written music as long as that was disclosed and everything. So so I had previously written this song, and I thought, oh, what a great fit for this. And turned out I got lucky and I was right.
Well, let's hear the song.
Great.
This is called I'm Home.
Making my way through the cool Kentucky rain, winding through rocky hills of green and gold. Windshield wipers brush away Naomi's tears. Semis screaming by like the rivers flow. Hypnotic highway lights put me in a trance, stretching somewhere between Des Moines and Council Bluffs. Chessboard traffic and Chicago, sinking in the mud in Kansas. I keep on driving, 200 miles to go. Smell of diesel in my mind, another cup of coffee. Change my strings, another day is done. Late night, sleeping all alone. The glow on the clock, piercing the dark. My mind is racing, I pick up the phone. another night moving down the road. The song is playing low on the radio. Driving 200 miles to go. Exit in front of me, and finally
that's Uwe Curlin, his song, I'm Home. It's featured on the Celebrate Columbus in Song CD. We'll have a link for you on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to check it out and learn more about the CD. Also with us in the studio is Jamie Goldstein. She's Vice President of Marketing, Communications, and Events for the Greater Columbus Arts Council. She was also a member of the Celebrate Columbus in Song Committee. Ruvane, the song never actually mentions Columbus.
It doesn't.
Which is very different, Jamie, than most of the songs.
But we could tell, I mean, we knew from the submission and we knew from the song that this is really the inspiration. This was the city that inspired him. We're just delighted that we had the interest and the participation that we did. Our idea for this contest was to create this community-based, inclusive effort for the Bicentennial, which is really at the foundation of everything that we're doing for 200 Columbus. And I think it's captured some of the best of that, which is really exciting. So, and if people want to hear most of the musicians play live, there's a concert at the Commons tonight.
That's
starting
right.
At 6 o'clock. So you'll be able to hear Ruvane and everybody that's on the CD. So that should be fun. And they'll all do their songs that are on the CD.
And we'll have a link to that, you know, to get more information about that event. So, Ruvane, is it, you know, you travel around the country, you sing for people all over the place. Is it a big deal to be on this CD?
Absolutely.
Now.
Are you kidding? I mean, there are 123 submissions. I feel totally honored to have been selected. And, you know, it's honor and twofold, because not only did I pass the requirements and the scrutiny of professionals in the field of media professionals and arts professionals, but I also had the support of the public, and to me that's a huge honor, and I'm humbled by that. It's really wonderful.
You know, when I first listened to the song, I kept thinking, okay, is he going to say something about what exit he's going to take? Or is he going to say something about what he's coming home to? But you never do. But you had to be visualizing something.
Well,
so when you sing it, what do you visualize?
Well, it's funny because I was just thinking about this. When I say exit in front of me, I always visualize and you know, the number is so large that, you know, I've done it a couple times, and I've kind of ad-libbed a couple times live, and it just doesn't flow very well.
Uh-huh.
But no, I live in Reynoldsburg, and so I always visualize the exit off of 70, and every time I sing a song, for some reason that little image pops up for me.
And when you sing that song, do you tell people where home is?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, especially when I'm on tour, you know, people are like, who's this guy? or where are you from? And, you know, so I certainly have the opportunity to mention I'm from Columbus.
Jamie, tell us about what's going to happen at the concert tonight, what the event's about, and what people can do to participate.
Well, just come on down to the Commons. It's free. It's
okay.
Free. And everybody except Joey Hebdo, who happens to be out of the country, unfortunately, will be performing, including Milt Ruffin with the anthem. And I believe that the mayor will be there as well, because he's really enthusiastic about this. And he came to the CD release party and met all the musicians and hung out for a couple hours. He really loves this project, which is wonderful for us. And a couple quick introductions by the sponsors, and then we're going to put up all the acts. Amber from Mojo Flow will be there to MC, and we're just going to have a great night of music.
Well, we can listen to the anthem now. Why don't we do that? This is the 200 Columbus Anthem by Milton Ruffin.
Come together today, hey, 70 belt, diverse. But you wanna be a part of it all. The Bucktown, start of it all. The talent, the art of it all. The heartbeat of the heart of the heart. You of it know, all. Like I know, we're the pulse of the OH. Columbus, we run this. 200, we run this. Two double bubble, two fingers up. Let's go, let's go.
Was Milton Ruffin commissioned to do this? How did the where did the anthem come from?
Yes, he was commissioned to do this. So he wrote the lyrics and put all the music together, and I think he came up with something that really captures the swagger that the mayor likes to talk about so much.
The old swagger. I kind of was joking earlier about the references to the Rose Garden. Of course, in now it's just escaping me. The park, Park of the Roses.
Park of Roses, Whetstone, right?
Were there recurring themes? Were there things like that that kept popping up in submission after submission?
Absolutely. The Short North and, of course, OSU and Jenny's Ice Cream, I think, was in a couple songs,
okay.
Of course. She's rather iconic these days, too.
Right.
So, yeah. To create a bicentennial flavor.
Yeah.
She did, actually. No. So, yeah, there were definitely recurring themes in the songs. The originality and the musicianship and the creativity were things that we all, interestingly, amongst a committee of 21 people who, as Ravine mentioned, representing media folks, arts folks, venue people in the music industry. I mean, we had a good base of experience, I think, to sort of review the songs. We were pretty much in agreement. I mean, when it came down to it, and from the top, you know, deciding the top 29, which was that was the only thing we had
okay.
a say in. The rest of it was complete. So from those 29, it was only the public vote. So the people, I don't know that if we had to choose the final, the committee would have picked the same ones. Perhaps not.
We'll never know.
That's exactly right. We wanted the public to choose the songs that they wanted on the CD. So,
well, Jamie, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ann.
Jamie Goldstein, she's Vice President of Marketing, Communications, and Events for the Greater Columbus Arts Council and a member of the Celebrate Columbus and Song Committee. And also, Ruane Kurland, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You heard Ruane a few minutes ago. He's a singer-songwriter, and we heard his song, I'm Home. It's featured on the Celebrate Columbus In Song CD. For information about the concert tonight and the CD, go to WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have all the relevant links for you there. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.